people like Wolfovich and Cheney and Rumsfeld who are proud of being hawks. What can you say about a mouse who pretends to be a rat? He's even more despicable than the rat.
What sense does it make for America to win any war when it's lost its soul?
This peace rests on the United States acquiring such an edge of military dominance that other countries have no incentive to compete with the United States.
We think that one of the ways to prevent a next war is to effectively counter the propaganda that has surrounded this war, to tell the truth about this war.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, June 5th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. President Bush addressed crowds of U.S. troops today during a stop at the command center for the Iraq invasion, praising the soldiers for their work during the war and pledging to reveal the truth on Saddam Hussein's banned weapons. Quote, "We've made sure Iraq is not going to serve as an arsenal for terrorist groups," Bush said in a speech at Camp As Sayyiah, Qatar, his coat off and shirt sleeves rolled up as he spoke to some 1,000 soldiers who cheered his words. Bush's visit came as questions swirl around his justification for invading Iraq, that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction and was poised to use them. Nearly 2 months after the end of the war, with visits to 230 suspected sites, still no weapons have been found by U.S.-led teams. Today, Chief U.N. Weapons Inspector Hans Blix warned against jumping to conclusions that the weapons are non-existent, saying Saddam Hussein may have destroyed or hidden the weapons. Blix is set to resign June 30th, but reiterated that his teams, which have been denied re-entry into Iraq, are ready to resume their work. Meanwhile, pressure is mounting on Bush, Blair, and their allies to produce the weapons. Spain's Socialist Party is demanding that Prime Minister José María Aznar, a staunch supporter of the invasion, explain to the Spanish Parliament what happened to the weapons. In the U.S., CIA analysts studying Iraq's weapons programs are quoted in a Washington Post article today saying they felt pressured by repeated visits from Vice President Dick Cheney to make their reports match up with Bush's policy objectives. U.S. Representative Joseph Hoffel, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, said yesterday at a House hearing, "Like millions of Americans, I'm wondering where the hell the weapons of mass destruction are." And Ohio Representative Dennis Kucinich plans to introduce a resolution demanding the White House detail its claims about weapons of mass destruction. British Prime Minister Tony Blair experienced harsh criticism in the House of Commons yesterday amidst charges that his Labour government doctored intelligence reports about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction to lead Britain into war. "Nobody believes a word now that the Prime Minister is saying," said Ian Duncan Smith, leader of the opposition Conservative Party. Smith accused Blair of equivocating and said that the whole credibility of the government rests on clearing up these charges. Among the more outspoken members of the British Parliament is George Galloway, who was suspended last month for accusing Blair and Bush of attacking Iraq, quote, "like wolves," unquote. Peace Watch reached Galloway earlier today and asked him about the political controversy surrounding the issue.
Well, you have correctly identified the harsh criticism he received in Parliament, but I can tell you that that's nothing as to the harsh criticism he's receiving outside of Parliament, where his writ no longer runs. In the country, in the mass movement against the war, in the media, left, right, and center, he is coming in for unremitting attack. And the case for the war against Iraq is now a smoking ruin. And Mr. Blair has not been helped by the excessive candor of the American administration officials, people like Mr. Wolfovich and Mr. Rumsfeld, who are brazen about the deceit that they practiced upon the international community. There's no other word for it. The lies that they practiced upon the international community when they claimed that Iraq was a clear and present danger to Great Britain and the United States and was bristling with weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological weapons, and was on its way to making a nuclear bomb. All of those things have turned out to be lies. The real reasons for the war are daily becoming more clear, and the grave consequences for Iraq, for the region, and for the safety and stability of the world are equally becoming clear with each new terrorist atrocity each new country that struck off the visiting list for British and American citizens, and each new threat that's received from around the world.
Mm. While there have been some concerns raised here in the U.S. around the lack of weapons of mass destruction being found in Iraq, the concerns seem to be a lot more intense there in Britain. More than 70 parliament members from Prime Minister Blair's own Labour Party have signed a petition demanding that Blair produce the evidence he used to justify leading the UK into war. One MP, Malcolm Savage, even went so far as to call the issue potentially more serious than Watergate. Where do you see all this headed in terms of political consequences for Prime Minister Blair?
Well, candidly, I think it will end in the same way that Watergate did, with the departure from the political stage of the leader, Mr. Blair. It's worse than Watergate because nobody died as a result of Watergate. Thousands of people have died as a result of this scandal, and the lives of the rest of us have been disfigured beyond recognition. The world will be a far more dangerous place for us and for our children. For a generation, we will pay for the crime that was committed against Iraq in the wake of the increased terrorism and hatred that has resulted from it. And Mr. Blair is all at sea. He is reduced as the most right-wing Labour Prime Minister in history to blaming rogue elements of the security services for his dilemma. The truth is that the rogue elements are not in the security services. The intelligence services are making it clear that they will not be held responsible. They will not be the scapegoat or the whipping boy for a political failure caused by the overweening ambitions of the Bush administration and the slavish obeisance to that administration by Mr. Blair and his new Labour clique.
But how important, how significant is it to have 70 parliament members demanding that Blair produce the evidence? Blair was in trouble around this issue, or in trouble going into the war. He didn't have a lot of support, and yet he seemed to have escaped any political consequences.
Well, it's 70 and rising. I think it's probably now more than 80. The numbers are growing by the day. And this reflects the feeling that I told you about outside. I'm speaking this evening in Ealing in West London to an anti-war rally. It's 15, 20 minutes before the meeting starts. There are already hundreds of people here. The movement hasn't gone away. And this is the difference between Britain and the United States. Mr. Blair only just got away with the war. He only just managed to persuade the House of Commons to support the war. The slavishness and the cowardice, I may say, of the Democratic Party in the United States gave Mr. Bush a much easier ride. But Mr. Blair didn't have that to begin with. And now that the occupation of Iraq is coming into a bloody disaster, with heavily armed soldiers firing on unarmed demonstrators, and then each night resistance forces in Iraq taking their toll on the occupation forces. Today, for example, one American soldier dead and several wounded in a rocket-propelled grenade attack in Fallujah. This bloody occupation, the rape of Iraq's wealth, where the Bechtel Corporation and 100 other companies of Britain and American origin are literally looting Iraq's wealth, handing out contracts for a country that they destroyed so that it can be reconstructed in their own image. This is becoming clear to the British people. And when you add on top the increasing evidence that the government lied to the party, to the parliament, to the people about the dangers that the Iraqi regime constituted for us and for our interests, then you have a prime minister bereft of any credibility. I'm sorry to say that the Conservative leader's comments yesterday in the House were absolutely accurate. Nobody believes a thing the Prime Minister says anymore, and not only on this issue, but on a whole raft of issues. So we're faced with the fact that in Britain, we had a government which was happy to reduce us to the tail of a dog headed by George W. Bush, which is not a very impressive head, and has then tried to deceive and lie and forge his way out of the questions that have been asked, and it's not washing anymore. And Mr. Blair is in very deep political trouble.
Well, what about the transcripts that have come out about the meeting between British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw and U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell that took place before the invasion began. It was reported that in a meeting between the two at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York, doubts were cast on the reliability of the intelligence information, with Powell at one point throwing his papers in the air and saying, quote, "I'm not reading this. This is bull," unquote. How big of a story has this been in Britain, and what effect has it had?
It's been a very big front page story, and it's just further evidence of the duplicity involved, because these two men who privately were expressing these doubts, well, doubts is not the word, privately describing the extent to which they found it all to be bull, then went on to the public stage like Hollywood actors and made a very good impression of believing every word of it. And what can you say about politicians as duplicitous as that? In that case, I think his conduct is even more reprehensible than the conduct of people like Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld, who are proud of being hawks. What can you say about a mouse who pretends to be a rat? He's even more despicable than the rat.
Well, Prime Minister Blair said that it was basically fiction, reports of this meeting, yet there are transcripts. I was wondering if the press had dealt with that aspect of the issue.
Yes, they have, and I think that tells you something about the extent to which the security services have lost confidence in their political masters, because these transcripts are presumably sourced in the security services who were recording the meetings and the discussions. The fact that they've made them public is another sign that they're not prepared to have the blame hung around their neck. The blame is being hung where it should be hung, on the political leaders who fooled the rest of us, or enough of us, into committing what was not only a crime — it was a crime, all right — but it was also a blunder against our own interests and against our own people's safety in the world.
British Labour Party member George Galloway, there's a campaign to reinstate you. You were suspended from Parliament last month for accusing Prime Minister Blair and President Bush of attacking Iraq, quote, like wolves, unquote. You were also accused of accepting as much as $600,000 a year from the regime of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. Can you describe the circumstances that led to your suspension, as well as the current status of the campaign to reinstate you?
Well, I'm not suspended from the Parliament. Only the people can do that. I'm suspended from the Labour Party. And there's a big campaign which has its first test on Tuesday at the party's national executive meeting, when a move will be made to reinstate me into the party. And we are quietly confident of success in that. There have been thousands upon thousands of pieces of mail have reached Mr. Blair and the party apparatus demanding my reinstatement. And in fact, the charge of receiving money was much worse than you say. The British and American press, the Christian Science Monitor and the Daily Telegraph, which is owned by a company on whose board sits Richard Pell, Henry Kissinger, and Margaret Thatcher, accused me together of receiving almost $20 million from Saddam Hussein. These are lies of ridiculous and fantastic proportions, which are now the subject of legal action. Two out of the three sets of documents which emerged from the smoking ruins of the Baghdad ministries immediately after the war have already been unmasked as forgeries. And I'm afraid that forgery, lies, and deception has been a hallmark of this entire Iraqi story. And I fully expect, not having been made rich by Saddam Hussein, to be made rich by the Christian Science Monitor and the Daily Telegraph in the libel courts.
So you are suing them?
Yes, of course I am.
And just for clarity purposes, Mr. Galloway, are you saying that you did not accept money from Iraqi President Saddam Hussein?
It's a preposterous, absolutely defamatory, fantastic lie.
Hmm. Just made out of whole cloth, or where would someone come up with such a accusation or allegation?
Well, I don't see how you can say that, given that you know that Britain and America submitted documents to the United Nations Security Council alleging that Iraq had procured 300 tons of uranium for the construction of a nuclear weapon, which in 48 hours was unmasked by the International Atomic Energy Authority as a crude forgery. So So I'm afraid lies and forgery are already interwoven into every page of this whole Iraq story, and I'm afraid this is just another one.
Okay. Any final thoughts on your part, George Galloway?
Well, I hope that the American people will waken up to the fact that they're led by an axis of evil, an axis of evil intent, which is going around the world stirring up enmity and hatred against us, against the British and American interests and against British and American people. And I hope they'll take the earliest possible opportunity to remove the world's worst leaders deploying the world's most dangerous weapons and threatening to use them again and again and again.
British Labour Member of Parliament George Galloway. Unnamed White House officials say they are spending hours dealing with unsolicited attempts by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to dictate foreign policy decisions. Last month, Bush had to step in to stop Rumsfeld from sending Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz to South Korea to announce that Washington is pulling troops out of the demilitarized zone at the border of North Korea. That action, analysts predict, would have embarrassed the South Korean president and sent the wrong signals to leaders in an already tense political region. This is not the first time Paul Wolfowitz has been entangled in potentially damaging foreign policy decisions. His outspokenness and cynical approach to foreign policy have troubled many international observers, including a recent statement that the weapons of mass destruction were merely a bureaucratic excuse for waging war in Iraq. But perhaps nowhere is criticism of Wolfowitz stronger than in Turkey, where some recent comments he made have garnered front-page headlines in all of the country's daily newspapers and sparked accusations of the U.S. undemocratically meddling in Turkey's domestic politics. From Ankara, Aslan Sarıyeldiz reports.
In an interview with CNN's Turkish-language television channel on May 6th, the Deputy U.S. Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz said, "It was disappointing that the Turkish military had not been forceful in pushing the country's parliament to cooperate with the American invasion of Iraq." His comments sparked an outrage in Turkey, where many observers interpreted them as calling for a military coup. Wolfowitz's statement is especially troubling to many Turks because the military has overthrown Turkey's civilian government four times since 1960. And today, the Turkish army has conflicts with the government again, as the ruling party, AK Party, is Islamic. İknur Hoca Softoğlu, a sociologist at Middle East Technical University, thinks that Wolfowitz's speech has to be analyzed from two sides: the Middle East policy of the United States and the change of Turkey's situation historically.
ABD artık bölgede reel olarak da bir güçtür.
The U.S. now exists in the area as a real power. It doesn't need any partners, as it has incredible influence in the region. Wolfowitz is criticizing Turkey for not cooperating with the U.S., but Iraq didn't want the Turkish military there. The reason Wolfowitz was so angry at the U.S. is because the U.S. now considers Iraq a part of the U.S. But without Turkey's support for the war, the U.S. has no need for Turkey anymore.
On March 1st, the Turkish parliament rejected the law that would have allowed the American military to launch a northern assault on Iraq from Turkey. According to Ecevit Softoğlu, the second phase of Wolfowitz's speech is the relationship of Turkey with the USA in the light of the AK Party's unpredictable nature.
Since the 1980s, it was always said that we were a strategic partner in our relationship with the U.S. We have always been seen as a trustworthy country and as an ally in the U.S.'s Middle East policy. So the refusal of the Turkish parliament to grant permission to the military to fight with the U.S. in Iraq was very surprising, both for the U.S. and for those Turks who have traditionally supported the U.S. The biggest reason was the decentralized structure of the AK Party, which makes it very unpredictable. Because the AK Party has such an eclectic membership base, it reaches out to all segments of the Turkish population during the elections. But that eclecticism was also a shortcoming when it came to developing an official stance of the party in the war on Iraq.
Wolfowitz has taken much criticism since the interview, with many charging he has sent an anti-democratic message to the rest of the world. Massachusetts Democratic Representative Barney Frank has called for his resignation. but the White House reportedly has voiced its continuing support for Wolfowitz as a, quote, outspoken supporter of democracy in Turkey, unquote. Utku Çakar, an international relations assistant at Ankara University, talks about the dilemma of the United States.
Amerika'nın Irak'ı neden işgal ettiğine ait soruya cevabı,
when asked why it's occupying Iraq, the U.S. says it came to bring democracy to that country. But at the same time, it's criticizing the Turkish government for making a democratic decision not to send its troops to participate in the war. So the U.S. is promoting democracy and criticizing it at the same time.
More broadly, Wolfowitz is seen by many Arabs as an obstacle to building democracy in Islamic countries. But last week, Turkey's Deputy Prime Minister Abdullah Gül made a passionate pro-democracy speech at a meeting of the Islamic countries in Tehran. And this is seen as a positive progress in means of democracy and adaptation of AK Party. While some authorities are nervous about the Islamic rules of the AK Party's government, when it comes to democracy, Utku Çakar thinks the contrary.
When you look at the Middle East today, there's no possibility of forming pan-Arab alliances. With the exception of Iran and Syria, the one similarity between the countries is that they all support U.S. policy, so they can't join together in opposition to the U.S. There has never been an example of pan-Arab unity in all of history. The tradition doesn't exist.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Özlem Sarı Yıldız in Ankara, Turkey.
The U.S. continues to extend its influence not only in Turkey, but across the globe. In a recent interview with Free Radio Santa Cruz, Richard Falk, a retired professor of international law at Princeton University, spoke of the construction of what he refers to as the new American empire. He touched on what he called the Bush administration's real motives for worldwide U.S. military dominance, and he explained how Iraq's weaknesses made it an easy target.
Iraq had been weakened greatly by 12 years of sanctions and the defeat in the first Gulf War. It had a dictator that was generally hated in the region and around the world. It had important strategic resources, and it was seen as an adversary, potential adversary of Israel, and a psychological support for the sort of violence that was associated with recent Palestinian tactics, including suicide bombings. So that for many reasons, Iraq was the most vulnerable state to this new phase of American global expansionism, and it was an easy kill, so to speak. And that meant that I would add another factor that's important. It gave the United States the opportunity to demonstrate to other countries that it doesn't care about the UN or about international law, that its voice is much louder and much more controlling than is the voice of the international community or of the legal framework.
This is part of the new American imperialism then. How does this imperialism differ from empires of the past?
I think it has several features that set it apart. For one thing, it has a potential global scope. No empire has ever sought to extend its reach to the entire planet so that it would, in a sense, be a borderless empire. Secondly, this is a empire that is powered by a visionary ideology where the combination of religious fervor associated with evangelical Christianity is linked to a neoconservative view of political leadership that sees the American destiny as one of controlling the future of the planet. And it sees it to such an extent that it justifies deceiving the public as necessary in order to carry forward what they seem sincerely to believe is beneficial for the United States and for the world as a whole.
Talk about some of those deceptions and the language that is used to sort of trick the American public.
Well, I think one of the ways that the deception is disseminated is to act as if the United States is not seeking imperial power, but is actually promoting democracy, and that it is championing the democratic destiny of peoples that are living under oppressed circumstances. If one takes note, though, of the concrete meaning of democracy, it's very strange. Paul Wolfowitz lectured the Turkish society because the military didn't override the rejection by the Turkish parliament of the American wish to use Turkish territory to mount a northern front offensive in the Iraq War, even though the Turkish parliament reflected the views of 94% of the Turkish citizenry. So what Wolfowitz was asking the military to do was apparently to intervene in the constitutional life of Turkey, to repudiate the views of the overwhelming majority of its people and of its elected representatives. And that conveys a very strange sense of what democracy means. It's also illustrated by the imposition of Abu Mazen as the Palestinian leader, who is touted as a great improvement over the allegedly autocratic Yasser Arafat. But the indications are that as far as the Palestinian people are concerned, less than 2% endorse Abu Mazen, or sometimes called Mohammed Abbas, as a legitimate leader and representative of the Palestinian people, while at least 21% endorse Arafat in that role. That isn't a great percentage for him either, but it's more than 10 times the support that the American candidate who's supposed to represent democracy is concerned. Another example is what President Bush calls peace. He, in his West Point speech and again in the introduction to the National Security Strategy document of 2002, says that we now have the greatest opportunity to produce peace in the world since the 17th century. And then he goes on to say this peace rests on the United States acquiring such an edge of military dominance that other countries have no incentive to compete with the United States. So it is the peace of imperial subjugation. And it is also a peace in which the rest of the world, in effect, disarms while the United States achieves this total domination that is sustained by military force.
That was Richard Falk, retired professor of international law at Princeton University. He was interviewed recently on Free Radio Santa Cruz. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.